This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
You know what's even better than a Jobs Day Friday? A Jobs Day Wednesday. Unless, you know, the news isn't all that good. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 5th of June. Good as always to have you along. Arguably, the three most relevant letters in this economy today are A, D, and P. ADP, it's a company, does payroll processing, among many other things. It is also, we should tell you, an underwriter of this program. But one of the things it does with all that payroll data it has is put out a monthly report on private sector employment, how much of it there is. And this morning, we learned that last month, there was less of it than we thought there would be. Just 27,000 new jobs last month, a giant drop from the 275,000 jobs ADP says we added in April. Now, one data point does not panic warrant, so bear that in mind. But one big reason for the weakness was small businesses. Companies with less than 19 employees saw a drop in employment. So what is going on with the little guys? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going.
Nick Giovanello opened the Sandwich King in Long Island City, Queens this past January. Sandwiches, yes, plus some hot foods and catering. He has about 5 employees, and he'd take another 1 or 2 if he could find them.
Yeah, it's hard to find good workers at a wage that is fair for both people.
He starts new employees around $14 or $15 an hour.
It's hard to compete with somebody that's offering $19 if you're just a deli, you know what I mean? How do you put that into your payroll? How do you fit that into your budget? It's impossible.
In a tight labor market where companies have to increasingly fight for workers, small businesses are losing the battle. Mark Zandi is the chief economist at Moody's Analytics, which puts together these payroll reports for ADP.
The small businesses are a distinct disadvantage relative to the big guys, because the big guys have lots of resources. They can raise wages, they can provide other benefits and attract workers. Small companies just don't have the ability to keep up, and they're not.
The smaller the small business, the harder the hiring. Companies with more than 20 employees are outcompeting those with fewer, says Jim Diffley. He's with IHS Market, which also tracks small business hiring.
Size matters here in terms of the ability to attract workers and the influence that this tight labor market is having.
He says in addition to higher wages and better benefits, workers may also prefer the stability of bigger companies. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
This being a presidential election year, and yeah, no, I know, not technically, but the 2020 campaign is already well along. A lot of issues are getting a lot more play than they ordinarily would. Our choice today? Affordable housing. Unaffordable housing, in reality, especially for would-be buyers and renters at the lower end of the income spectrum. It's become a talking point on the presidential campaign trail, affordable housing has. But what defines affordable? Well, it turns out there is a definition, at least a guideline, really. 30%, 30%, housing costs should not exceed 30% of your income. I know, I can hear your eyes rolling from here. Here's Marketplace's Amy Scott to break it down.
Like most sound economic policy, the 30% benchmark comes from an old adage.
That a week's worth of wages should allow for someone to pay for a month of rent.
Dan McHugh with Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies says actually it's a little more scientific than that. In the late 1960s, Congress based federal housing subsidies on studies that had shown the typical family spent about 25% of its income on housing. Then in the 80s, McHugh says,
the single 30% rule was adopted across all of the HUD subsidized housing programs.
And somehow, like the 2,000-calorie diet or the 10,000 daily steps we're supposed to take, that became a rule of thumb for everyone.
It makes absolutely no sense in an economy as diverse as the United States is.
David Beery teaches public policy and economics at Virginia Tech. He says high-earning families can often afford much more than 30%. For others, even 30% is too much. For example, he says people in low-income neighborhoods tend to live much farther from their jobs, so their housing may be technically affordable.
But then they end up spending so much more money on commuting, which is really what kills them financially.
There are other ways to gauge affordability, says Diane Yentel with the National Low Income Housing Coalition, like how much money a family would need after paying for housing to afford basic necessities. But that's complicated to measure on a large scale.
For now, at the federal level and among most housing experts and researchers, the 30% threshold is the right place to start.
At last count, 38 million Americans were paying more than that. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, there are some changes coming to healthcare for veterans. As we all know, changing healthcare is never easy, so we will break that story down for you. On Wall Street today, traders took the Powell put, the belief, reality-based or not, that Fed Chair Jay Powell is going to cut interest rates to keep stocks rising. They rolled in some, hey, maybe those Mexican tariffs aren't actually going to happen on Monday anyway. And they went on a buying spree. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Well, let's see now. What does the latest version of the Marketplace Edison Research National Economic Poll have for us today? Well, here's something. And remember, we asked a bunch of questions about work and the places where we work. Turns out the majority of American workers think a warm, friendly environment is important on the job. But about half the workers that we polled had been yelled at by a coworker, and more than a third admitted to yelling themselves. So, from the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that story.
Yelling can mean a lot of different things. It can mean frustration, like Michael Scott in The Office.
No! God, please, no! No!
It can mean desperation.
Show me the money!
Like Jerry Maguire, of course. Or it can be intimidating, like Ari Gold in Entourage.
The next person to mention Richard Roper will be fired.
All of that yelling comes from essentially the same place as Leanne Davey, a business strategist and author of The Good Fight.
It means that their emotional reaction to the situation has kind of overflowed the bounds of what would be normal behavior.
Something she says is not at all surprising to encounter in the workplace.
It gets people to pay attention if they haven't been. It gets people to move more quickly if they haven't been.
Which is why in some high-pressure industries, yelling is practically in the job description.
Yelling just in and of itself is pretty normal where I work. Just a pretty effective form of communication, I think.
Nicole Doucette is a securities trader and says high-volume exchanges are an everyday reality.
You hear, you know, someone's voice getting raised and then a few swear words, and that's perfectly normal. I can't say that I get immune to it, but it also isn't as disruptive as I imagine it could be for some other people.
People like Irvin Wheeler, an artist in Atlanta, Georgia, who is working for an after-school education program, not exactly what you think of as a pressure cooker environment, until he got a new boss with a confrontational style.
I went to her office to tell her that I didn't think that that was the right approach. And it got to a point where she got so agitated that she was screaming at the top of her voice. And she said a few things to me that I can't repeat.
He started dreading going into work every day.
It was deadly. It was an eating away at you. It was, what am I going to confront today that's going to take a little bit more of my soul from me?
When yelling creates a hostile work environment, it can have very negative effects, according to Robert Sutton, an organizational psychologist at Stanford.
People have more depression and mental health problems. They're more likely to get physically sick. They're less likely to work hard. They're more likely to be less creative. And they're more likely to make mistakes.
Sutton says while social movements like Me Too have brought greater awareness to abusive behaviors in the workplace, most national surveys don't show much evidence of improved civility.
There's a bunch of countervailing forces. People are working under more pressure and more hours than they have before in the past, which makes people grumpy.
If you're one of them, says Leanne Davey, taking a pause for self-reflection could go a long way.
Figure out, why am I getting to this point so frequently? Maybe you're exhausted. Maybe this is about not investing in sufficient sleep or eating the right food or just getting some fresh air during the day.
Still, she says, yelling might have one advantage over other modes of confrontation. Unlike slacking or emailing a nasty message, the fallout is seen face to face.
The key thing is that in response to that, then, that you actually talk about the issue.
The operative word being talk, ideally in a nice inside voice. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Of all the pictures from the demonstrations in Tiananmen Square 30 years ago this spring, the crackdown in Beijing was 30 years ago yesterday. Maybe the most iconic image came the next morning, June 5th. Tank Man is what the picture has come to be called, one guy standing up to that line of Chinese army tanks. In the West, the protests are remembered as a call for democracy, but they had economic motivations as well, as Marketplace's Jennifer Pak reports from Shanghai.
In the heart of Shanghai on People's Square, a bell tolls on top of a tower. The tune's familiar to Shanghai native Charles Liu.
You know what that music called? The East is Red.
From the mid-1960s to the 70s, it was the anthem of the Cultural Revolution, when half of Liu's family was forced to work in the countryside. Back then, the Communist Party controlled pretty much everything, especially jobs, even when Liu graduated from college in 1982.
I was assigned as a teacher in the same university.
How much were you earning then?
Start from 45, 48 RMB.
That's less than $10 a month at today's exchange rate. But his employer fed and housed him. Meanwhile, China was changing. The Communist Party was loosening control. That meant Liu could sip Coca-Cola and listen to imported music by Taiwanese star Teresa Tang. But the reforms also led to double-digit inflation. In the summer of 1988, the government announced it was lifting price controls.
There was panic buying. People rushed to buy everything ranging from mattresses to, famously, toilet paper.
Julian Gewurz is the author of a book on China's reforms called Unlikely Partners. He says some university students also felt left out of the new economy.
One dimension of that is corruption and nepotism, the idea that the jobs were being given to the well-connected.
The students also wanted more political and personal freedom. In mid-April of 1989, they began protesting in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. Protests began in other cities, then the workers started to join in. That's when the government decided enough was enough.
Because the Chinese leadership at this time has looked at what caused movements in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe to be so threatening to the ruling communist parties. And worker participation is one of the central facts.
On June 4, 1989, China's leadership ordered the military into Beijing. Troops shot and killed at least hundreds of demonstrators. Today, the government stands by its decision. Earlier this week, Defense Minister Wei Fenghe defended the crackdown at a regional forum.
The government was decisive in stopping the turbulence. That was the correct policy.
We don't know how many people in China agree with him. The Communist Party censors, even detains those who want to commemorate the incident. But the party did make some concessions towards the protesters' demands, says UC Irvine professor of history Jeffrey Wasserstrom.
There was a sort of deal struck without ever being described that way. How about if we give you more choices in various realms of your life, but not in the political realm?
There are still gripes about corruption and inequality. Officials monitor them, even in private online chats, to avoid a repeat of 1989.
They allow them to let off steam if it only involves one social group, one issue, and one part of the country. And sharp messages are sent very quickly if any struggle starts to spill over.
That's the tallest building I remember in my childhood.
Standing on People's Square, Charles Liu is proud of how China's developed. Yes, his family was ripped apart during the Cultural Revolution, but they reunited, and he and his siblings all found good careers and can retire comfortably. To him, that matters a lot.
In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Coming up.
What are successful companies out there? You got Apple, fruit, Lululemon, another fruit, right?
I mean, she's not wrong. How does figs hit you? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 207 points today, more than 0.8%, 25,000 to 539. The NASDAQ climbed 48 points, 0.6%, 75.75. The S&P 500 advanced 22 points, 0.8%, 28 and 26 there. Told you about some of those Trump administration restrictions on travel to Cuba, including a ban on cruise ships. Well, that hit the travel industry. Norwegian Cruise Line sailed down 3 4/10%. Carnival fell 2.6% today. Procter & Gamble joins a growing list of companies that plan to try out refillable packaging to reduce waste. The company announced its Olay brand is going to test a reusable container for moisturizers. Procter & Gamble boosted 1.9% today. Bonds fell not too much, though. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note remained at 2.12%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal with an introduction or two.
Heather Hassan, co-founder and co-CEO of Figs.
And?
Trina Spear, co-CEO and co-founder of Figs.
Two people, same job title, one company, a medical apparel business called Figs.
Where are we going?
So you are about to enter, Trina,
our warehouse.
We're about 30 miles east of Marketplace World headquarters in downtown Los Angeles in City of Industry, California, which does live up to its name. Lots of corporate offices and blocks of warehouses. And inside one of those warehouses, Heather and Trina lead me through some big metal doors at the back of a small-ish office space.
Notice, not an exit.
Here we go.
Oh, yeah, it's a warehouse.
Oh, okay.
There's a lot of shelf space in here. Holy cow.
Yeah.
The place is huge. Cardboard boxes with Figs logos printed on the side are stacked on shelves reaching almost up to the very high ceiling. Medical garments, scrubs, for instance, are give or take a $10 billion industry in this country, and Figs has a small but growing slice of it. It's direct to consumer, which means the stuff coming through this warehouse is going directly to the nurses and doctors who ordered them instead of going to a retailer first. Same model, really, as a bunch of other companies you know, Warby Parker, Casper Mattress, Dollar Shave Club as well. I started by asking Trina for the elevator pitch. What is Figs?
Figs is the highest quality medical apparel company in the world.
That's a big statement in the world.
It's true.
Okay.
And we've really spent a lot of time focusing on fabrication and fit and comfort and functionality for the medical professional.
If I say scrubs, is that not what you're doing? Or do you just not say that word?
Scrubs is definitely a big part of what we do.
All right.
It's not everything, though. We're a lifestyle company, a lifestyle brand.
How do you get lifestyle out of medical scrubs?
So all of our product assortment goes well beyond scrubs into lab coats and underscrubs.
Gotcha.
And vests and fleeces, everything the medical professionals wears to work, at work, and from work.
Fair enough. let me get this out of the way to begin with. I thought honestly, until I started doing the research for this interview, I thought hospitals just gave their doctors and nurses and orderlies scrubs that they wore and then washed and then, you know, went home in civilian clothes. Does that not happen?
So that does happen. So 10% of the market, yeah, right now, the hospital actually gives you your clothes, right? But the 90%, they buy direct. Wow. So that's where we come in.
So folks have to buy their own uniforms, in essence, to wear to work.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So let's walk and talk. You guys lead the way.
All right. So to your right, we're coming upon our receiving area. This is where all of our shipments come in from overseas, we have facilities around the world.
Can I just ask, not that necessarily it's a thing for you, I don't honestly know, but since they're in the news, if I say tariffs, what do you think?
That is a thing.
I mean, textiles are really heavily tariffed.
Yes. I mean, I think for us, we've been really monitoring tariffs closely. Obviously, you've seen what's gone on in China. We've been monitoring the situation over the past year. We've been fortunate enough to move a lot of our manufacturing to other countries. It's really a minimal effect.
And I think that's the beauty of our supply chain, where we're all over Asia, we're all over South America, so we're able to be nimble and move around if something happens in the economy.
All right, so I'm seeing a lot of boxes here. This is all like plastic wrap stuff, so I don't want to open it up. But can you give me something I can like feel and touch?
Yeah, let's go check out.
Let's open something up.
All right.
This is amazing. Boxes. This is our mauve color. So this was a limited edition color that we came out with about a few weeks ago.
Okay.
During Nurses Week, which is our Super Bowl.
Of course it is. No, that makes total sense, right?
And so what you see is super soft.
Right. Well, before you start describing this, what do regular scrubs look and feel like, right? Because not everybody has that experience.
Regular scrubs are cotton. They're big. They're boxy. They're itchy. They're unflattering. They're not something you want to wear to work.
We should say here, you have a background in fashion and style.
I do.
Yes.
I do.
And so did this just like grate at you when you had it? I mean, how did you come to this?
I was in pre-med. I was in pre-med. Yeah. I didn't think about it at the time. But when I was in pre-med, I wore huge cotton scrubs, like giant scrubs. And you're working on, you know, cadavers and whatnot. But Trina and I realized that, hey, there's no reason why people should be wearing cotton scrubs or huge scrubs, right? We should make scrubs that actually are conducive to their environment.
Okay. So back to the mauve pants.
So wrinkle resistance, four-way stretch. As you can see, a yoga waistband.
Yep. Oh, it feels nice. It's not scratchy and cottony and gross,
thank
right?
God.
Look how cute.
Oh, there's the top.
Look how cute.
Okay. So, I'll give it to you.
In a modern styling, right?
Right. I talked to a couple of my friends who are medical professionals before this chat, and generally positive reviews, but some of them were like, $38 for a scrubs thing? I don't need that. What is that?
Well, that's... You know, those aren't really our customers. You're right.
Oh, snap.
Yeah. It's okay if somebody wants to buy a $10 scrub. Not everybody's our customer. We're a premium brand.
When you started this company, what, 5-6 years ago, right? Plus or minus? Did you bootstrap it yourselves? Your own credit cards maxed out and all that jazz? Or how'd you get off the ground?
Oh, this is a good one. So in the beginning, yes, we had actually one of our factories front some of the production, which was huge for us. And then I spent all my money, and then Trina liquidated her 401k.
Wow, that's a gutsy move.
Huge gutsy move.
Not smart, necessarily. People would advise you against it.
Most would advise against it, but I think that it was worth the risk.
Wow. That's a big put up or shut
up. We went all in. I mean, I think, now we're seeing the fruits of that labor. But I think if you don't believe in what you're doing, how are you going to get other people to believe in what you're doing? And so we really went all in from the beginning.
What else do I need to see?
Let's go see our embroidery workshop.
Oh, all right. Wow. So this is like, John Doe, MD on the front
that's
chest
right.
or whatever it is. All right. Oh,
so
look, you can hear the sewing machines already.
Right now. This is where personalization happens.
All right. These are all computerized sewing machines? Really? Of course they are.
Yeah, everything's technology
driven. Come on. Of course they are.
There you go.
Do you find any peril, not to get all macro, but it is kind of my gig. Do you find any peril in this moment in the global economy?
I think there is a lot happening around the world that is scary. As it relates to our business, we are a bit insulated. And the reason for that is because of the industry that we operate. We're in healthcare. The largest, fastest growing segments in the population. What we do is actually pretty recession proof. Doctors and nurses aren't going anywhere. Yeah. There's some AI and robotics coming into what we do, but people need to go to work and they need a uniform to do that. So as we think about all of the different elements. We're monitoring it closely, especially what's happening in China right now. But we've been fortunate to be able to be flexible in shifting our supply chain around. I mean, adaptable. I mean, this is why these corporate companies that you're seeing around the world, this is why they go out of business, is because they're not nimble. They're not thinking about the future. They're not setting themselves up for all different types of situations that are going to happen over the next 10, 20, 100 years.
Figs, by the way, where'd that come from?
I just love fruit, and I love figs, and that's where it came from.
Really?
Totally.
That's so...
If I eat fruit...
Like avocado.
I'm allergic to avocado, actually.
Are you?
Totally.
So is my son.
No, but figs, so I thought about it. One, I love fruit. And two, I thought, what are successful companies out there? You got Apple, fruit. Lululemon, another fruit. Right? Figs.
Amen.
Fruit.
I'm done. Let's get out of here. You guys have work to do.
Your son's allergic to avocado?
Yeah, his mouth gets all tingly. There was more to that conversation with Heather Hassan and Trina Spear than we had time for here. How they navigate that whole co-CEO thing, for one thing, and why their digital ads seem to be everywhere right now. Go ahead, Google Figs Medical Apparel. See what happens to you. You can hear all that on our Corner Office podcast. Final note on the way out today, apropos, I think, as Air Force One flies in Europe, taking the president tomorrow to Normandy for 75th anniversary celebrations of D-Day. Remember last year, the president said he wanted to overhaul the plane's paint scheme, red, white, and blue, he told CBS News. Quote, Air Force One is going to be incredible. It's going to be top of the line, top of the world, and it's going to be red, white, and blue, which I think is appropriate. End of quote. Congress, at least the House Armed Services Sea Power and Projection Forces Subcommittee, ain't having it. The panel has drafted legislation that would prohibit spending money on a new paint scheme for the plane without congressional approval. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 207 today, more than 0.8%. The NASDAQ up 48.6 tenths%. The S&P 500 advanced 22.8 tenths%. Our media production team includes Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.